Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Hey friends, before we get to the show, let me tell you about something that I'm really excited about. May 15th and May 16th, down in Houston, Texas, the Praxis Conference will be going down. There's going to be a lot of former guests of the show, people you're going to recognize, people like Ian Cron, Brian Zahn, Sarah Bessie, Science Mike. They're all going to be there because you know what the Praxis Conference is? It is an outstanding event. What it's going to be doing is it's going to be a collaboration of academics, artists, and reflective practitioners focused on reclaiming the historical church's liturgy, art, and sacred space for contemporary evangelical ministry context. When you go to praxisconference.com and register, which is something I know everyone's going to want to do, type in praxis_Norrisworthy, and you're going to get a 25% off discount. So make sure you go to praxisconference.com for more information. I hope you go register today if you haven't done it already, and I will look forward to seeing you down there. So, without further ado, here it is. Welcome back to the show, friends. Today we have returning to the show from the city of brotherly love, Dr. Peter Enns. Welcome back.
Hey, Luke. Thanks for having me.
This is your third time, isn't it?
I don't know.
I think it is.
I don't remember. Yeah, I think you're right. This is the third time. Yeah, that's right. Last time was last fall.
Mm-hmm. We did.
And I think the time before that was maybe the summer or spring. I can't remember.
Yeah, we did one in the summer, talking about your old book. And then when your new book came out, we talked about it. I think it was August, September. When did it come out?
Early September.
Yeah, so we talked about right around when it went out to release date.
Yeah. So this is the third time, so you have a slow week, huh?
Yeah, we have a slow week. You know, your friends at Harper One bumped someone's release date back, and so I had to get a fill-in, so that's
new. Yeah, so happy to do it. Happy to do it.
You're so nice. Now, the real reason I need to talk to you is because kind of a bone to pick with you. It's involving a little Twitter interaction that we had, and I feel like I got the short end of the stick.
Okay, explain.
Well, I was out minding my own business. I come inside, and I see a tweet from 2 hours before. It's from you to Pete Rollins, and I'm included in the tweet. And it said something to the extent of how much you liked Pete Rollins' stuff when he was on my podcast.
Right.
Which I was really happy. I like to bring two people together, especially smart people like you guys. And so I tweet and I say, that's great. It's like you're two Petes in one podcast.
Right.
Which I thought that was pretty brilliant. And you,
okay.
And
it's
you,
okay.
You mocked it.
Well, what did I say?
You said something about it took you 2 hours to come up with that.
Oh, yeah, I did say that. Well, it did.
Well, it's not like I was staring at my phone 24/7. I might have been.
How do I know? How do I know that?
Well, I don't. But my response is still true. It's not like all of us got into Harvard. So it might take me 2 hours to come up with that, and there's nothing wrong.
I should make fun of the disadvantaged, I guess. You're right. I apologize for.
Hey. Coming from the guy
pointing out truth,
who was trying to promote his book by saying it's now selling for $2.99, it's cheap as dirt, and you try to make some pun off the title of your book, I feel like my pun was equally as justified.
Okay.
Do you have anything you want to say to me now?
If that's that's how you can process this and work your way through it, that's fine.
I'll take that as an apology.
Good, okay.
So, had you heard any of Pete Rollins' stuff before?
No, that was just the one podcast I heard. I've certainly known about him. I've peeked around on his website and just, interesting creative sorts of things. So I just listened to the one. I forgot which one it was. I think it was when his new book came out, maybe last spring. And I just thought it was interesting. And, I like hearing people that I intersect with a little bit. It's nice knowing that you're not completely alone. Not that we would necessarily see everything eye to eye, but who does?
In what way do you think your work and his work intersect? Because obviously he's a philosopher, you're a text guy.
Right, and he's not a text guy. I mean, that's pretty clear to me, which is fine, but I'm not a philosopher either. I think it's more just looking for different ways of connecting with God that go beyond the common strictures that I think a lot of Christians feel, things like letting go of the need to be right and certain, and a spiritual life is one of true exploration. And I don't mean that in a willy-nilly kind of sense, but just, you know, you don't know. Mm-hmm. And part of what we do as responsible people, I think, is try to figure things out and move forward. And the journey and pilgrimage metaphor are good ones, I think, for the spiritual life. And I take those very seriously. So I'm sort of on the lookout for that kind of, when I hear language like that, I say, there's somebody maybe I can talk to.
What does it do for a trained, you know, scholar to talk about not being right, since the majority of your life is working towards you being right? Isn't it? Like, you're trying to understand, this is what it says, and this is what it means, and this is how we understand God correctly.
Yeah, I would put it this way, okay? I think you're right when you put it that way, but I think, you know, the more I experienced it in graduate school too, the more I sort of learned, the more I realized there's just a lot I don't know. And I can't really hold on to some of these conclusions that I'm coming to with an iron fist. And I think the difference is you sort of reach a point where, you know, being right and having arguments are important to you, but the need to be right is not as important. And so you can hold on to those kinds of arguments and debates a little bit differently. And I think that's not just for scholars, but I think for, you know, normal everyday Christians, I think we sometimes collapse the quest for truth, let's call it, and for formulating theology and articulating arguments. We confuse that privilege and that very normal human thing that we do. We have, you know, cerebral cortexes. We can think abstractly. We confuse that with needing to have our thoughts be aligned properly so that we can have faith properly. Hmm. And I think that's sort of where I've in my life drawn the line. I don't go there.
Yeah. When I finished my undergrad, I was a 20-year-old who had, you know, preached at a little country church for 2 years, and I had interned at two churches, and I had far more confidence in my competence to be a minister than I did after I finished my MDiv and after doing 10 years of ministry.
Right. And you have kids too, right?
I have three kids, yes.
Yeah, how your daughters, right? Is that a daughter?
Yeah, I have 6'3" and a 1-year-old.
Yeah, and that changes things too, right? Because, you know, you think differently, and the older they get, you've been told this 1,000 times, but it gets worse.
Thanks,
you know,
again, Pete.
Talk about lack of control of your existence. You know,
yeah, so. You don't. And I heard someone say parenting is like living with your heart outside of your chest. And I can't control the things that matter most to me, and that's my daughter's welfare and them always being safe. It's out of my control. But even with like theology, I was just talking to someone the other day about this. There's so much out there that we can assume that I've got the right opinion about, you know, the sovereignty of God or how to understand text or, you know, authorial intent, but ultimately I don't know. And one of the things I love about your work is that you always go back to the center is Jesus. And
right.
If you have like a centerpiece, it's always about love. It's always about Jesus. I'm centered on that, but everything else, I don't hold as tightly to anymore.
Mm-hmm. You're interested in it though, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You're interested, but it's not a matter of, oh my gosh, if I'm wrong here, my whole faith collapses. And you know, not to paint with too broad a brushstroke, but that is sort of the fundamentalist evangelical problem, I think. That it's a theology that has to be worked out. Everything's a Jenga tower. You pull one thing out, it all falls apart.
Yeah.
And that's just a hard way to live. That can make you nasty.
Yeah, it can. And it's like, you know, one domino or Jenga thing, whatever you want to call them. If they fall, then everything else falls down and your faith collapses.
Right.
And then you're just in serious trouble. I mean, if one thing falls apart. But if you hold those things loosely, it seems that you can interact with those materials and ideas a whole lot easier.
Yeah. I think maybe there are two extremes we're talking about here. One is where the life of the mind and thought are, whether we admit it or not, actually central to our faith. But the other extreme is when it's nowhere to be found, you know. And I think for a lot of people like us, you know, we can't get rid of our heads. We're sort of born the way we are. But we have to remember, too, that aligning these things is not the essence of the Christian faith. It can't be. Mm-hmm. There's too much diversity.
Yeah. I liked how you just grouped us together. Like us scholars like you and me, We need to be reminded of that. So,
hey, dude, you graduated college at 20. Did you get kicked out?
No, I skipped a year of high school and I started school early, but but I went to a school called Harding when I was 16. I didn't get into Harvard, so they sound similar, but it's a big
close
difference.
Enough.
Yeah, it's, if you get some duct tape, you can make the shirt look that way. But yeah,
school people from Texas that way probably. I'll bet.
Don't bring Texas into this. All right.
You know,
I actually was born in West Philadelphia. It's where I was born and raised, but I've since then become enlightened and moved to Texas.
Yes. Okay. Whatever.
So, yeah. You know. Okay. Let's talk about you had a blog post a couple days ago. It was like five words to define pedants.
Right.
Which I really appreciate you saying up front that you don't have to be married to the idea of always being right, because you said five words. The first one is really two words that you hyphenated. The second word isn't really a word. You just kind of made it up.
I made it up a long time ago, so it's good now.
How long ago do you have to make a word up for it to actually count as a word?
I'll check with my lawyers. I think it's seven.
7 years ago? That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, but these...
Well, longer than that, actually. It was more... That word actually came to existence. I'll tell you the little story here. I started teaching at Westminster in 1994, and within about 2, 3, 4 years... A few colleagues of mine, we were just talking about the synthesis of, you know, biblical theology, but also taking into account just the nature of how Jews handled texts around the time of Jesus, which is very creative. And we just sort of came up with this term Christotelic, which was really jumping off of Richard Hayes's notion of an ecclesiotelic reading of the New Testament, which is the goal of the biblical story is actually to create a new people of God. The telos, the goal, is the church. And we sort of co-opted that and made this word Christotelic out of it. So, you know, it's sort of, it was a collaborative effort, but I'm the one who put it in print and both loved and hated for it. So that's
So your colleagues who helped you come up with it, they don't have to get the nasty emails, but you do.
Exactly right.
They sound like they might be a little bit smarter than you. Because they're like, Pete, you just do this. We're going to be behind the scenes cheering you on. Okay, but let's talk about this. I really am fascinated by this Christotelic interpretation. And first of all, before we get to the specifics of them, I thought these five really did encapsulate your work really well. As
Thank
someone
you.
Who's yeah. read a couple of your books and you know follows your work, this is Pete. So well done on that. But this Christotelic reading, which is a nice way to say that in the first century, people used the Old Testament in ways that if I used that in a Bible class as an undergraduate and used the Old Testament the same way they did, it would be counted wrong.
Yeah, because we have different expectations of what proper interpretation are in the modern world, and that's why the term is for some people very problematic. But, you know, it's basically a rereading of Israel's story. It's a rethinking, a reframing, a recasting of Israel's story in light of what is functionally an unexpected ending to Israel's story, which is the death and resurrection of the Messiah. That's not really an expected ending. And so, you know, you see Paul, for example, I would put it this way, you know, a theological mind and a missionary mind wrestling with Israel's story to... establish and forge these connections between the Old Testament and the gospel that he's preaching, using the only language that he really has available to him, which is the language of his scripture, the language of what we call the Old Testament, and drawing these connections of both continuity and discontinuity between, you know, the gospel that he's experienced and Israel's story that, you know, it is on some deep sense connected to the story of Jesus, but also doesn't have categories to actually adequately handle that story.
Yeah. Okay, so as someone is starting to work through Scripture with this Christotelic way of understanding how first century writers were writing, what is the, like, therefore? Like, what is the so what that they get when they go read their Bible, they're studying their Bible, they're trying to understand what Paul's doing? How does it affect how people today should read their Bible knowing this?
Well, I think it affects us in one important, I'd say even fundamental way, is realizing that the center of our faith is Christ and not the Bible. And I know that isn't that could be taken in many different, very negative ways. But I think what we see when we're watching the New Testament writers handle the Old is the centrality and even the hermeneutical determinative nature of the Christ event for how you handle the Old Testament. So in other words, the way a friend of mine put it to me once, even the Old Testament bows the knee to King Jesus. Hmm. And it's now shaped around this ending, and you re-understand it. And I think what that does for me, I mean, from a very practical point of view, a spiritual point of view, is that it really is about Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the starting point and ending point. It's not the thing you can get to logically. You know, when you watch Paul handle Israel scripture in Romans, just you know, pick apart, you know, quote after quote after quote, he's taking things out of context in the strictest sense of the word and re-understanding them, in some senses even like counter-understanding what these texts were doing in their original context. And that just tells us that, you know, Jesus is here, and we're watching this energetic, creative, theological mind who can't complete sentences, or his sentences go on for two pages because he's just so excited, you know, and he's trying to get this across to his audience. And I think that some of the enthusiasm and passion that we can see in how deeply committed they were to what they experienced, you know, in that first century world.
Yeah. Would you be comfortable if your preacher, if he or she got up on Sunday morning and decided to preach this same way from the New Testament and played kind of fast and loose, as long as the centerpiece was always Jesus, but if they kind of did their own kind of midrashy reading, would you be okay with that?
Well, here's the little secret. They all do that.
Wait a minute. I hope my church members aren't listening thinking I do that.
That's
I'm
okay.
Sure everyone except me does that. Wait, seriously, do you think everyone does that? How so?
Well, for example, I mean, Robert Gundry, years ago, when he was booted out of the Evangelical Theological Society for writing this commentary on Matthew, and how Matthew's, understanding is very midrashic of the Old Testament, how he fits Jesus in a midrashic kind of way. And I think it was R.C. Sproul who went ballistic, and he wound up getting thrown out, and Roger Nicole was involved in that too, I think. I don't want to throw these names around if I'm not 100% sure. But the point is that, you know, in his response, Bob Gundry, he pointed out a sermon that R.C. Sproul preached and how utterly midrashic it was. We use the text and we have a jumping off point, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in a sense of the word, all theology is midrash. All theology is taking texts and putting them together and collecting them in a way that makes some sense for us coherently in the way we think about the nature of life and the nature of reality. There's no pure theology, right? So in a sense, you know, everyone has to, you have to do something with texts, especially ancient texts, to make them contemporary,
mm-hmm.
which is the essence of this actualizing tendency in ancient interpretation, that, you know, you show respect for the text by not leaving it back there, but by bringing it into your present and by connecting those two worlds. Now, the question is, you know, would you feel comfortable somebody doing that with the New Testament? I honestly can't answer that. It depends on a lot of factors, you know, what they say and how the community responds to it. And, you know, even answering that question that you're asking, I think is more than simply a rational process. You know, I think if people are helped, it makes a big difference.
So you just said my question's irrational.
No, not your question. Rational, just you, your very existence is irrational. I don't think your question is irrational. I just think, you know, thinking through that, we're still presuming that we can sort of line things up easily and say, this is wrong exegesis, this is right exegesis.
Yeah.
Right. So, and that's unfortunate, but it's true. And I think of it more as, and again, metaphors are not always the most helpful things, but instead of thinking of here's a box, you don't go outside of it, or here is a line in the sand, you don't cross it, I think of it more as a fog or a mist or a cloud, where sometimes you're closer to the center, sometimes you're further out, but you're still sort of in this somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And there comes a point in time where, like, you're way out, and then people, the community needs to call you on that, right? But that's not as logical and rational as I think some people think that process is.
Yeah. We like to get up and say, this is what the Bible means right here, and this is right. The only way to understand it, and if you don't, you're wrong. But we need to get to a point where we say, you know, we're all working with the text here, and we're all interpreting it, and we're making moves, and we're all making choices on it. Just like an actor has to make a choice with a role, we're making choices. But it doesn't sell as well if we say that. It works a whole lot better if we say, this is the only thing you can really intelligently believe about the text.
Depends on who the customer is, right? I mean, I think for a lot of people, it does sell very, very well. And, you know, I'd like to point out to people when that comes up that, you know, for most of the history of the church, they embraced multiplicity of meaning in a text. And that was actually a good thing to do, which is very much the history of Judaism as well. It's the text, because it's divine, has depth. And you will see things differently, and you have many, many different kinds of valid readings of texts. Rather than, you know, because it's sort of this constitutional authority, you have to get the one meaning down to guide us in our life. You know, if it were that easy, we would have figured that out by now.
Mm-hmm.
And we wouldn't have literally thousands of Protestant denominations.
Yeah. Which, by the way, you had a cartoon about the denominations you posted.
Oh, yeah.
Which is outstanding. It, I think I've used it in a sermon already, but if you haven't seen it, it's this cartoon, and there's this massive chart that shows like a plethora of different denominations, and the guy is in front of the class teaching a new member's class, and he points to the very tiny dot on the bottom right corner, and he says, you know, this is where we are. Isn't it lucky, or isn't God lucky we finally got it right? Or something like that. Which is kind of like the egocentrism that most of us, like I have sometimes, where I want to say, my little, you know, flavor of Christianity is the one right one.
Right. But and, you know, I have that tendency too, and I want to be mindful of that.
Yeah. But this is another one of your 5 points. This one actually is a word, which is really good. Ecumenicalism. Ecumenical. That's, you want to be this ecumenical person that incorporates not just your flavor of Protestantism, but Catholicism, the bigger traditions. And which probably didn't come natural to you, did it? Is that something you've grown into?
I think, you know, growing into it's probably a fair way of putting it. And there are many sort of shifts, but the big one was, you know, going to Harvard and having Jewish professors and seeing how much they revered their tradition and how much they knew and how much I could learn from them, not just about Hebrew, but about theology, about how texts work from a literary point of view and a theological point of view, not to mention history of interpretation. So, and I think even from, you can learn from anybody. I mean, you know, I think God surprises us. And I think to humble us, we learn from people we might not want to learn from. I mean, I had something up on my blog or on Facebook or something a few weeks ago, because John Dominic Crossan has just released a book, How to Read the Bible and Still Be a Christian. Mm. And it's about violence in the Bible. And he has sort of I'm only a few pages into it, but he has sort of a unique way of going through it. But, I mean, the comments were like, he denies the resurrection. How can you possibly listen to him? And I'm like, I learned from Jews.
Yeah.
You know, I learned from, what do you mean? We can't read books, and there may be tremendous insights in that, but particularly because maybe he doesn't have some of the same baggage that some people, not that the resurrection's baggage, but, you know, the defensive sort of apologetic posture that, you know, you might actually learn something. But, I mean, the vitriol that came out in some of these comments was just simply amazing to me.
Yeah, yeah. First of all, my last guest, Brian Zahn, had a copy of that book right next to him. I think he's reading it as well. So you both are heretics together. But, okay, so one of the questions I get, and, you know, my listeners have heard me say this before, but is I get often asked, well, do you agree with every one of your guests? And there's no possible way you could have 50 or 60 or 80 or however many guests it's been at this point who have written books, who have strong opinions, strong ideas, and actually line up with every one of them. And I think I think your stuff on conquest narrative, how you think, or one of the options that you offer in your newest book, most recent book, is that it possibly never actually happened.
Yeah.
I think that's the one that like seems to like encourage people to say, Luke, you don't agree with everyone, Peter ends, everyone on your podcast, right? And I say, no, I don't. If there was a poll right now and there's only one person going to heaven between me and Peter ends, I feel like I probably have a better shot than him, but that doesn't mean I can't read his books, right?
Yeah, right.
Now,
exactly.
I think you got it.
Good for you. Bully for you. Look, you're expanding your consciousness.
I think there's a good chance you can make it to heaven. If it's up to me, I'll give you a reference. Now,
well, it's like I tell my students, Luke, I say, you know, if theological precision is requisite for getting to heaven, I'm going to be so lonely. Right?
Yeah, you are going to be lonely.
And I'm going to get an email saying, I can't believe how arrogant he is. He really thinks I'm just kidding, folks.
He's sarcastic. Yeah. Okay, one of the people that I see you reference a lot on social media is Richard Rohr. And I'm a big Richard Rohr fan. I'm going out to see him in just under 2 weeks, actually, which I'm
super good for you.
Yeah, super pumped about that. And I'm interested, like, what is it like an intellectual person, like an academic like you reading Richard Rohr, how does that work? It seems like you would have to have grown into that, because I'd assume the guy who first was in seminary probably wasn't reading a whole lot of Richard Rohr stuff.
Correct. Yeah, I think, I mean, the short version of that really long story pilgrimage, again, is a word that some people hate, but I think it's a beautiful word for describing this. It's really after I left Westminster, you know, when I resigned or was forced to resign, whatever you want to say, I really had I was in these moments where I just had to, I didn't have these structures around me to define my faith for me without even knowing that that was happening. Hmm. And once those structures were gone, I was really going through a rather lengthy process of just, who am I? You know, what do I think? And that and that. And I got introduced to Rohr and to some other people like Thomas Keating, another renegade Roman Catholic contemplative kind of folk. And the long and short of it is that they helped me to see, along with others, along with just people that I knew, how important it is for people like me to honor my head but not live in it. And that was a new concept for me, because my whole theological existence was arguing or defending. Mm-hmm. And it's always about better arguments, and sermons are 45 minutes long and they wind up being expositions of a doctrine, or, you know, the whole Sunday experience, it starts with Sunday school, and, you know, that's what you do, and it's all about information, grasping information, controlling it, and that's the center out of which your faith actually grows. And I needed desperately to get away from that, because it was killing me. And so, again, you don't leave your head, but you don't center everything in your mental processes. And I think Richard Rohr, for me, was one of these people just at the right time who sort of modeled that in his own way. I mean, I haven't duplicated his life. You know, he doesn't duplicate mine, but I found that it was really hitting some nerves for me to really conceive differently of how, what does it mean to be Christian?
Yeah.
And that was important to me. So
when I first read his stuff, it was a couple years ago, and I think I've told the story before, but a couple books came in. I happened to open up the book Everything Belongs. I think that's the title. Just I had a package from Amazon. I bring it inside. I'm literally, headphones are in, running clothes on. I'm about to go out the door. I open the package just to see what it is, and I start reading Everything Belongs, and I sit there for 45 minutes, an hour, and I read almost the entire book, maybe half the book or something like that. And it was just like the floodgates opened, and there was something that he was talking about that just I hadn't tapped into in so long, and it made so much sense to me. Now, you said something I need to follow up on. You said when you left Westminster, there are structures that were gone. What did you mean by that? What structures?
What I mean is a particular theological tradition that was very strongly guarded, and you were a part of it, right? And there's movement within that tradition, but by and large, you know, it's this is the truth. I mean, I don't think this is a bad thing to say, because it's a very public. It's actually written in an article where one of my colleagues would say things like, "The Reformed faith is Christianity coming to its own. We don't exist to dialogue or partner with other traditions. We exist to correct them. We hold the truth in trust for other traditions." That's the mentality, which I always sort of resisted, but you're still a part of that, and your structures are defined for you very clearly.
Yeah.
This is what the Bible is. This is how God works. This is the nature of God, the nature of Christ, the nature of the Holy Spirit, the nature of the church. You have all these theology classes. And, you know, once I left that, you know, And again, this is a process. It didn't happen immediately, but within a few months or a year, it was like, I don't have to believe that way. Mm-hmm. So what do I believe? Mm. And the only way I knew of being Christian was by processing information. Mm. And I didn't have an anchor. You know, I didn't have something, a home base to come back to. There was no home base anymore for me in terms of a tradition. And so I had to think, I mean, that sounds contradictory. I had to think differently. I had to think about how to decenter my thinking.
Yeah, that makes sense. You've talked about that a little bit. I think there was a controversy with, oh, that Tullian something who's got the, he's like Billy Graham's grandson.
And right. Right.
Nadia's friend. I don't know how to say his last name, but there was a blog post about that you wrote after he left the Gospel Coalition or team or the Gospel Superheroes or whatever that group is called. And someone said something about it's not about the theology.
I think it's called the Avengers, but anyway, God, yeah.
Uh-huh. No offense, Gospel Coalition.
No, none at all.
Fans who are listening, we appreciate you listening to the podcast and buying Pete's books. But you were making the comment that. In response to someone who said, it's not about the theology that's causing the split. And you said, no, the theology does cause the way of thinking that leads us, which is a very fascinating comment that you made.
Yeah, now, I mean, I learned that, you know, over the years too, that your theology actually does determine how you act. Mm-hmm. It does what you think it does or doesn't, it actually does. The way you conceive of God or the Christian life does affect how you treat other people. There's no question.
You know Richard Beck, right?
Yep.
Okay, so Richard once said that the way we read the Bible, it's not so much about how we read the Bible, but how we conceive of God. And that shapes our interpretation of Scripture. Like what we bring to the table is this is the filter of who God is. That shapes how we see everything. So.
Right. Hey, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, you brought the pilgrimage. Like you used that word like 18 minutes ago when we started this rant. And that was one of the five words that you talked about. Like this is Pete N's five words, pilgrimage. And I want to talk about that. Now, it seems like a lot of the idea of pilgrimage is that we're getting to a better place. Like, personally, I can see that. Like, I'm growing, you're growing, we're all trying to become better people, and better people being defined as becoming more like Jesus, and like the spiritual formation process, mm-hmm. which we all hope to be a part of. But as, like, as a universal, like, are we as people progressing? Like, that's an interesting question to me. Have you listened to Rob Bell's got a podcast now? And
you know, I haven't listened to it yet now.
Okay, well, first of all, I appreciate you listening to my podcast and not his. might hurt his feelings. I don't know. I think he gave you a blurb in your book. So,
yeah, that's it. Well, Luke, just keep those checks coming and I'll keep listening. Yes,
definitely. Just don't cash them. They're going to bounce. But he made a comment, and this wasn't the first time he said it, but he talked about one of those terrible texts in the Old Testament where, you know, you go to war, you can take the dead guy's wife that you just killed, but after 30 days, if you don't like her, give her a certificate of divorce and let her go. And Bell's point is like, well, that's nicer than everyone else was treating people in that situation back then. And now to us now, it looks awful, but to them, it was advancement.
Right.
And so I get that. Like Bell's point makes complete sense to me. But like the bigger question is, are we really as humanity getting better? Wasn't the postmodern experience like, yeah, we were supposed to be getting better, but then we dropped a few atomic bombs and the Holocaust happened and, you know, Rwanda happened. Are we really progressing as people?
Well, I mean, I think there's always crazy and evil, you know, that is always going to be with us. But, you know, I think, for example, today, I mean, it's hard to speak of the world, but just of my own country, things like, you know, equal pay for men and women is at least very much. I mean, my mother lived through that. She was paid 2/3 of what she was worth. Right. You know, that's on the consciousness of people. Mm-hmm. You know, I think race relations are in the consciousness of people more over the past 50 years than they may have been in America for the 50 years before that. Right. And I think in that sense, there's progress, but, for me, progress is not something ending in a utopia. This is not, you know, the 19th century liberal mistake. We can fix it by being just who we are. And you know, that's when World War I happened, and that's when Karl Barth wrote his Romans commentary. That was the bomb dropped on the playground of liberalism, or whatever that famous quote is, you know, that showed, you know, people are screwed up. And, you know, pilgrimage doesn't, in my mind, in any sense deny that, and actually it acknowledges it, because I am on a movement, I am on a journey, I can't just stay where I am and it's fine. It's not fine where it is, although it's fine for now where it is. You know, it's not about progress, I think. It's just about we're all, it's actually for me more an acknowledgement that we all are actually journeying in some sense.
Yeah.
And being aware of that and embracing it, no one's actually standing still.
Yeah.
You are on a road going something. You might be sort of cemented into the mud for a while, but you're still on a path.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a nice thing to know.
One of the things I've started to realize about, especially like this podcast and the people who listen, it seems like there is kind of like phases in the journey that a lot of us have gone through. Like the first phase is like this phase in which we feel like we have all the answers, and you have this nice, compact, tight picture of who God is and how the world works. And eventually you realize there's holes in this, and water starts to seep in, and it just doesn't hold up like you want to. And then you start asking questions, and the whole thing falls apart. And it's like the second phase that like people sometimes just like give up. Like, there are too many questions, I don't know what to do, and so I'm just going to give up on faith altogether, or I'll just go through the motions. I've got to go to church because I have social expectations to be there, but I'm not really dialed into it. But there's some people who kind of push through that and get to, I think what Ricord talked about is the third or the second naivete.
Right.
Where you have this, like, and this is what Rohr is to a lot of us. Like, he's, there's another way past like this simplistic, I have all the X's and O's understood. No, I don't, but I still have something. But I love this pilgrim language because it's talking about that. But I was talking to a friend I actually had recommended your newest book to her, and she read it. She liked it. And she was talking about she doesn't know enough to really have a strong opinion on things. And she knows enough to, she's going to go read Pete Enns' book, and it's going to help her start thinking and asking these questions. But she realizes, like, she has a job. She's got kids. She's a full-time whatever. And so she can't spend 40 hours a week wrestling with these ideas. And what does it mean? Like, how does someone in that situation where they realize it's far more complicated and complex than what they originally thought?
Right.
How can they continue like this pilgrimage? Where do they go to kind of get?
Well, yeah, I think that's a very good question. One thing I would say right off the bat is by learning to acknowledge that I hate to keep coming back to this, but the rationalistic solving of problems is not the most important thing. It's simply acknowledging that this is where you are at the moment, but that doesn't affect who you are. Even if doubts are coming into your mind, you know, or just you're not seeing things the same way and you're a little bit concerned, you're still in God's hands. And that process of working things out, that will work itself out eventually. And you can't study for 40 hours a week, but, you know, maybe you can read a book every month. You know, I mean, and that's the way you're going to work through those kinds of things, you know, because some people are actually wired, I think, to want to learn and want to know.
Yeah.
Plenty of people aren't, and that's fine. But those who are, they almost have that added burden of I need to sort of absorb some things and do some reading. And but as long as we don't kid ourselves into thinking that if I read a few books, I'm going to be back to that secure place of knowing and of being certain. You know, that you're not going to necessarily be back there. You might be pushed out of that at this point, and you might not return back to that safe place. But I think that's part of growing up.
Yeah. It's almost like at first you feel like you've got your feet firmly planted on something. And then if you get it, like you're on the beach or something, and if you get drug into the water, you'd be out of control. And like that second phase is like you're trying to figure out how you can keep on breathing, and you're trying to kick off the bottom to get above, and you're dog paddling. And then when you get to the third phase, it's, I'm comfortable in treading water. Like, I know I'm not touching the ground, but I know I don't have to sink either. Like, there's another way to keep going.
Right. That's a great analogy. I agree with that. I think it's for people whose faith has been rooted in staying on the shore at all costs, and if you don't, you lose your faith. That's the terrifying thing. And, you know, the roars of the world and others, they will, you know, help us understand that that's actually not faith.
Yeah.
You know. That's the false understanding. It's the false self. It's the false knowing, and it's actually disruptive to truly growing in grace.
Yeah, and so the fear is like if you leave the beach, you're going to go down the slippery slope.
Right.
Why is a slippery slope? It's always towards, it's always like left. Like it never can go right. It's never like, you know what? I'm going to have this same view of women's role that I see in the Bible. And so eventually that's going to lead me to have the same view of slavery. Like, it's never like there's a slippery slope to, you know what, slavery is really not that bad since the Bible says it. Just like it says women should be, you know, second-class citizens.
Right.
How come
it's,
why is it always to the left and never to the right?
I think that's probably an American cultural thing. That's still the DNA coming out of the fundamentalist, modernist controversies of the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's that simple. You know, we have in our DNA generations of you got to hold on to the faith, you got to defend it. Yep. Here's what it is, and we had those Germans in the 19th century attacking it. We had Darwin attacking it. We had archaeologists attacking it, and we've spilled precious blood, folks. And we're going to stick to our guns here. And you know that kind of DNA. It's hard to. That's the only faith some people know. Mm-hmm. And you know that might be more of a Western cultural thing.
Yeah.
No, which really bothers me when that's exported to other parts of the world,
like
and that's modeled as Christianity to other people. That we're bringing our cultural baggage to others. That's the problem, I think.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. And so it's all about defense, which is it's weird because God doesn't seem to like always have to defend himself. Like your stuff about conquest narrative, like this, like the really terrifying passage in the Old Testament, God encourages genocide and terrible treatment of children and women and just awful stuff. Well, so one of your takes is, you know, maybe that's what they thought God said. Another one of your takes is, well, maybe they're just saying this as posturing to their neighbors. Mm-hmm. But let's just say your crazy heretical ideas are actually true. Okay.
Yeah.
Big if. But if that is true, what does it say about God that God doesn't feel the need to correct all that stuff?
Right. Maybe. I mean, I'm filtering all this stuff through where I am right now. But maybe it's to show us that, you know, the certainty of knowing is not the center and heart of it. You know, we're watching the spiritual journeys of people unfold in the Bible, and it's not there to give us the kind of information that we in our context might very much want to have.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was reading this morning, one of my favorite Psalms, Psalm 89, because the psalmist calls God a liar. You know, hey God, you promised David would have a dynasty that lasts forever. And he would always have one of his descendants, the Davidic line, you know, would never end. And God, you're steadfast. Your love is steadfast. We can count on it. And you're the creator. And you're the one who split the seas, and then all these things go on, Psalm 89, and then you chose David, and you promised, you know, he'd defeat his foes and his line, blah, blah, blah. And then he says, yeah, but, you know, it doesn't seem you stuck to the bargain here. Mm. You know, you know, we're in exile, basically, and the Davidic line did end. And so what kind of a God are you? And, it doesn't, it ends with sort of this tone of like hopefulness that God will finally come through. But the fact is that, you know, there isn't a psalm after that correcting that.
Yeah.
Right.
The psalmist should be like called to the principal's office and said, you can't publish this.
He should be fired from his temple work or whatever he's doing, right, for uttering something like that. But that's why I think, you know, those, you know, what Walter Brueggemann calls the counter testimony.
Yeah.
Old Testament, those parts that don't fit into that nice main narrative where things work out, you know, where God rewards the righteous and punishes the wicked, like Psalm 73. But then the psalmist says, well, it's not working out for me. I see the opposite. I see the wicked prospering. So what's up with that?
Yeah.
Right. And those are just good things to have in the Bible.
Good. Yeah, they're good to have. But to get there, I mean, that's a lot of people's experience, and it's nice to have that named and say this is part of how the church sometimes responds to God.
Right.
People
exactly
do that.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Let me transition. Let's talk about what's going on in Pete's world today.
Okay, let's do that.
I heard a rumor that you have the audio book coming out but you didn't actually record it yourself.
No, I didn't.
Why not?
I think it would have been a disaster. You know, I mean, you have to have people who know what they're doing. Mm. I probably would have added stuff. I didn't mean to say that. I would have put like a different sentence or something. That would have been more terrible. So, but yeah, no, it just it came out actually in the fall. I asked because people were asking me, "Is this going to come out in audio?" And I said, "I don't know. Let me check." And I talked with Harper One. They said, "Well, we don't really know at this point because I think a lot has to do with things like, you know, whether it's something marketable for for good reason. You know, whether the book's doing well enough that this is something worth doing.
If something actually like people want to buy it."
I know.
It's amazing. It's like a company has to actually make money. It's so weird.
You know, they're so selfish.
I know.
Yeah, I don't want to make money. I don't care about that.
Well, you're a college professor, so you're...
I'm used to no money.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I just want positive cash flow. Anyway, but...
but you've got... okay, so that's coming out.
Came out. Yeah, I just got it 2 days ago, and I've actually been listening... This sounds horrible. I've been listening to it in my car to sort of remember what I said, and...
oh, gosh.
It's good. You know, it's... I mean, it's... Joe Barrett, he's done like, I think he's done a 247 books. He's an actor who's had some credits, you know, in the past, I think starting in the 80s or 90s. But I recognize his voice because I've listened to audiobooks before, and I said, this guy's done this before. So I did a little Googling, and there he was. So.
There he is.
But yeah, he gets all the intonations of the jokes and stuff, so that's pretty cool.
Wow. That's pretty impressive. He got your jokes. That's good in itself. Hey, you've also got this. You got two more things I'll talk to you about. You've got the re-release this summer, 10-year anniversary.
Yes, of Inspiration and Incarnation.
Yeah,
Evangelicals and the Problem of the Old Testament. Yeah, so that's pretty cool. It's a new cover, and it's got a preface explaining, you know, why we're doing this and sort of how this book is the same, how the book is different. I was thinking of like even changing the content a little bit because, you know, I mean, things have happened in the past 10 years, including with me. I don't think exactly the same way that I did 10 years ago. And I was thinking, you know, should I update it to sort of reflect where I am now? But, you know, I was very explicit in the preface saying, no, just this book is a standalone thing. It's helped a lot of people, and it's something that can be adapted and used for different people in different places. So let's leave the content completely alone. I touched up maybe a dozen places where I thought things weren't clear, so it's really a matter of a couple of words, not anything substantive. Mm-hmm. I updated the bibliography. I added things to it. But the main thing is there's about a 7,000-word postscript where I deal with, like, the reception of the book. And I deal pretty directly and pretty pointedly with some criticisms, nothing, you know, on a personal nature, but just sort of, I think a lot of the responses in the evangelical world were just simply not helpful. I don't think they really understood what I was trying to do in the book, and I think they simply misunderstood things that I was saying, so I had an opportunity to sort of go back, revisit some of those things, and say, listen, this is what I'm doing, this is why I think it's a good idea.
If we have you back on right around when the book comes out, can we get the personal nature stuff, like the personal attacks that you didn't include in the book?
Okay. Yeah, I love that. So.
But you will do the personal attacks then. So we'll put that down on the calendar. And aren't you are you working on another book right now?
Yeah. I'm almost done with the draft.
Almost done with the draft.
Yeah, I'm almost done with it. The draft's due next month, so we'll see how that works out.
So it'll be out in like 2019?
No, actually, it's slated to come out winter of 16. So I think, you know, by this time next year, it should be out. That's the plan, and I don't see any reason why we won't be able to keep that. So,
what's the synopsis of that one?
Okay. Trusting God when knowing what you believe doesn't work anymore.
Okay. Yeah,
that's the gist of it. Yeah. Working on titles and stuff, and you know, I've got like 3/4 of it written, and the other quarter I know what I'm going to do, and I have a lot of it laid out. It's a matter of filling in the details. So.
Okay. I'll send you a few title options that I come up with.
Okay.
Pete, it's always fun to talk to you. Thanks for your time, man.
You betcha. Thanks. It's good to be on the show again. We'll talk another time.
We'll have you back again soon. All right. See you, Pete.
Bye, man. See you, Luke. Yep. Bye.
All right, friends, hope you enjoyed that one. And don't forget to go to praxisconference.com. If you haven't registered today, make sure you use the code praxis_Norrisworthy because the Praxis Conference is going to be exploring the implications of being formed by Christian time, the limits of Protestant spirituality, the nuances of ecumenism, and how the great tradition calls us into participation of both common and redemptive grace. It sounds like a lot of fun.
I hope you go sign up, and I hope I see you down there May 15th and 16th in Houston, Texas, the Praxis Conference. Thanks again, y'all.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. We'll see you back here next time.